Great American Ballpark. It's the Better Off Red podcast. Here's your host, Jamie Ramsey.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining me for another episode of the Better Off Red podcast. We're going to dedicate this episode to longtime Reds clubhouse man, Bernie Stowe, who passed away earlier this week at the age of 80. Bernie spent nearly 70 years in the Reds organization and touched the lives of so many generations of Reds players and fans alike. This one's for Bernie. Our guest today is former Reds pitcher Jack Billingham, but before we get to him, I want to introduce you to an indie rock band from Madrid, Spain that I've been spending a lot of time listening to called The Hinds. They've graciously agreed to provide today's podcast music from their new album, Leave Me Alone, which is available now on iTunes. This is Hinds with the song Garden. Our guest today pitched in parts of 13 big league seasons, including 6 years in Cincinnati as a member of the famed Big Red Machine. In 1973, he started 40 games, pitched 293 and a third innings, collected 19 wins, and finished with a 3.04 ERA while earning his only All-Star game selection. Over 7 World Series games with the Reds, he allowed just 1 earned run over 25 and a third innings. He was part of one of the most notable trades in baseball history when in November of 1971, he was acquired by the Reds from the Astros along with Cesar Geronimo, Dennis Menke, Ed Armbrister, and a fella named Joe Morgan in exchange for Lee May, Tommy Helms, and Jimmy Stewart. This is Cactus Jack Billingham. Hello, Jack Billingham. Welcome to the Better Off Red podcast. I'm so thrilled for you to agree to come on with us, and I really appreciate it.
No problem. It's bright and early down here in Florida, and sun shines out, and it's beautiful.
Yeah. You're a Florida boy, aren't you, through and through?
Well, I was born and raised right outside of Orlando, a little town called Winter Park. But I retired 10 years ago and moved over to New Smyrna Beach, and it's just south of Daytona. My daughter lives over here, and I got 2 grandsons that live over here, and that's just about my life right now, following my grandkids around.
Of course, that's what a grandparent's supposed to do, right?
Exactly.
You mentioned growing up in Florida. You played Little League Baseball with future Reds manager Davey Johnson, isn't that right?
Yes, we did. I always tell him I hit more home runs the last year of Little League than he did. But he left halfway through the season. That's the only reason I won that home run hitting contest. So, no, Davey and I grew up together, playing sports and playing baseball. And he had a great, great career.
Sure did. Do you still maintain ties with him?
I run into him every once in a while. He still lives over in Winter Park area. Last time I ran into him, he was opening up the Little League program, which we both played in, and I went over there with my granddaughter to play softball in that program, or used to play softball in that program. But we have mutual friends that we run into periodically, and they said, Davey said to say hello, and this and that. But about an hour away from Winter Park, and like I say, I don't get out. We get to do quite a few things, but our life is mostly around our family right now.
Sure. And, speaking of family, the Reds just recently were informed that that Bernie Stowe, longtime clubhouse man, had passed away this week. I know you were obviously you were tight with Bernie because you know you were in that clubhouse for 6 years. And can you tell us a little bit about what Bernie meant to not only to the Reds but to you personally?
Personally, Bernie and I became friends. When I first joined the Reds in spring training in 72, and I got to know him real well. I talked to him a lot. I was coming up to Cincinnati, didn't know anything about the town, and Bernie, being a native of Cincinnati, and where he lived over in the Western Hills area, he recommended that my wife and I go over there. There was an apartment complex over there that rented to people part-time, so we moved over there, and we had a great time in that part of town. The funny part is that Bernie lived over there by us, and we got in the World Series, gave him a full World Series here in 72, and he moved out of the neighborhood. But Bernie was a special type of guy. He was your classic clubhouse man, clubhouse manager or whatever. He was actually part of the Big Red Machine. You know, he traveled with us. He was there before we got to the ballpark. He was there when we left the ballpark. He never had an argument or with anybody. He always was pleasant. You needed something, Bernie was always there to find out how to get it. If you couldn't get it, he would find out how to get it. After a good game, he was the same as after a bad game. When you came up to clubhouse, he always called me John. My name is John. My nickname is Jack. Hello, John. How are you doing? Hello, John. You know, good game, good game. Or you know, just hang with him, John. Get him next time. You know, he'd always with a smile on his face. So if you had a bad game and you came up there and Bernie was in the clubhouse, he just made you smile. He made you forget something, like you had a bad day. But there's two people that I think that can never be replaced in the history of Cincinnati Reds, and that is Joe Nuxall, as everybody knows, and Bernie Stowe. I mean, those are two fabulous Cincinnati Reds people who were born and raised in that area.
Yeah, and we kind of spoke about it a little bit yesterday off the air about how Joe and Bernie also had like a special relationship, and they were not only, like you said, two of irreplaceable figures in Cincinnati Reds history, but they were best of friends. And you know, you saw that firsthand, and I'm pretty sure wherever they are now, and we talked about it yesterday, they're probably sitting at a table trading insults and talking about old Reds players.
They're sitting there having a beer and laughing and remember good times and funny times. And they were just two super, super individuals. I just loved, you know, talking about the clubhouse and Bernie. The day I pitched, I'd always go out and have batting practice and come and sit in the clubhouse. And Joe and I would just sit there and I'd listen to him telling old stories or just stories about ball players and laughing and, you know, that can never be replaced. That clubhouse can never be the same. Even though Bernie's kids are running, you know, Rick's running the home clubhouse and Mark the visiting clubhouse. It's not the same. It's never going to be the same.
Right, right. Well, we'll move on to a little bit of a happier subject. Not that, you know, Bernie wasn't, because he was probably one of the funniest guys that I've ever known, as you probably can attest to. But you were, is it true that you're a distant cousin to Christy Mathewson?
Well, my grandmother always told me that.
Yeah.
Don't ask me how I am. she always told me that, and I mentioned that years and years ago when I was coming up in the minor leagues, and boom, it showed up on a Topps bubblegum card. And I get asked that all the time. But he was, my dad was from New York. My grandmother was from New York. He was up around Monticello, New York. And it was a my grandmother's sister, somebody. I really don't know, but my grandmother was so proud of it that Matheson was in the family, and she actually had given me some newspaper articles when I was in high school. But as a normal high school kid, I have no idea. They're in the trash somewhere. I lit them to start a fire somewhere.
Well, if your grandmother says it's so, then it's got to be so. You always listen to your grandmother, right? Well, let's kind of dive into a little bit to how you became a Major League Baseball player. You were drafted and signed by the Dodgers in 1961. You spent 7 years in the system, the Dodgers system, before making your Major League debut. And, you know, a lot of people, they think 7 years in the minor leagues, how old was he when he made his Major League debut? You were only 25 in 1968 when you came up. That's a testament to, you know, how the model of baseball, I guess, you draft and get these guys in young and then, you know, savor a player's peak years. And that's when you came up at the age of 25 as a member of the Los Angeles Dodgers. What was that like pitching for the Dodgers in your Major League debut?
Unbelievable, you know, to me. And I say this, the Dodgers used to be one of the best organizations in baseball, and they still are a good organization. But when I came up, you know, we had Drysdale was still playing. Walter Austin was the manager. I spent 7 years in the minor leagues, and if anybody's ever been down to Vero Beach in Dodger Town, you know, we all went to spring training together. We all more or less got on the field together. If the major league, when you were in the minor leagues, the major league needed batting practice pitcher or something other, you always were called over there, you know, to pitch against the Maury Wills, Frank Howard, those guys. It was just a class organization, and they were known for pitching. And I spent 7 years in the minor leagues. I think possibly I might have been able to, in another organization, be able to come up a year or two earlier. But when it was all said and done, I felt like when I did get to the big leagues, I was prepared and I was ready to pitch in the big leagues. I was actually brought up with the Dodgers. They groomed me mainly as a reliever. Mm-hmm. And I came up with them in 68. It was just great. You know, Dodger Stadium, I'd never been in anything like that. You stand out on the mound and you're surrounded by stands, and out in the outfield mountains or hills and that, over the stands. It was just beautiful. You know, it was one of the, and still probably is one of the prettiest ballparks, because all they do there is play baseball.
Yeah.
You know, most of the other ballparks, they played football and they have events and this and that. But it was just absolutely. And when you spend 7 years in the minor leagues and the general manager tells you you can look for an apartment, it's quite a thrill.
Wow. I bet it is. At some point when you were a Dodgers farmhand, isn't it true that you contemplated quitting because you weren't making a whole lot of money at that level, and you were going to get married, and you thought this isn't going to work out?
Well, I'd played for 3 years, and back then they called it. We had D ball, C ball, A ball, Double A, Triple A. Now they have it. They just changed it. They have A leagues, but they have low A leagues, middle A leagues, and high A leagues. So I don't know who the genius was that thought of that, but. I played in T-ball for 2 years. They sent me to C in Santa Barbara, California, and I think I was making $350 a month after playing 3 years. And everybody on the team was from California.
Yeah.
There was only about four of us that weren't, and we had Mondays off. And I didn't have a car, didn't have transportation. I was engaged to be married, and it just wasn't working out. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking, you know, I knew how to work for a living. Unfortunately, I signed right out of high school. My dad had a Standard Oil gas station I was raised in, and I knew I could always go back there and take over the gas station, work hard. And I called Fresco Thompson up, who was the farm director, and I said, look, this isn't working. And I said, I need more money, and you need to send me to St. Petersburg, Florida, where I'd be closer to home.
And what level was that? What level was St. Pete?
That was D-ball, back to okay. D-ball. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't pitching in Santa Barbara. I was just wasting my time. So about 2 weeks later, the manager walked up to me, and he says, I got bad news. And I said, I'm going to get released. They're going to send me home. And he says, we're sending you to St. Pete, and they want to tell me they're going to give you a $50 raise. Which I went, yeah, great. And he says, what? And I said, great, that's what I want. And so I went down there, played for a guy by the name of Roy Hartsfield. Mm-hmm. He pulled me in his office, and he said, Jack, I want to make you the stopper of this team. You got some experience. And from then on, it was like I was in St. Pete, went to winter ball in Nicaragua, got married, took my lovely bride to Nicaragua on our honeymoon. And I played with him the next 2 years in AA and AAA. And, you know, when you have somebody that really believes in you and talks to you and helps you, that made all the difference in the world. And getting married, I had a little bit more responsibility, mm-hmm. and it just worked out. I was very fortunate.
And that was great for the Dodgers to do that for you.
Yes, yes. And Frisco Thompson wasn't known to be nice to people.
Hey, how was Nicaragua?
Nicaragua was quite an experience. You know, yeah. when you're 21 years old and your bride is 19 years old and she's never been away from her mother, and I marry her and take her down there for 3 months. And we live in a town, Granada, Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. No hot water. The hotel, I don't know, didn't have screens on the windows.
And oh, boy.
The beds were about 2 inches. The mattress was about 2 inches. They were like old army barrack mattresses. Wow. And it was a great experience when we look back on it. And we both say we'd love to go back down there.
Yeah.
And just see what it is like. Beautiful country. The people were nice. The baseball was very good. Mm-hmm. It built my confidence up because I came out of D-ball. And when you go to winter ball, it's at least AA, AAA, big league ball players playing. Mm-hmm. And I had success down there after coming out of D-ball. So that was kind of boosting my morale and helped me with the future of my career.
Yeah. And you said the baseball was good. How are the crowds? Did they get behind baseball in Nicaragua?
They're crazy. They gamble. They fight. They light newspapers. Now, we're talking about in the 60s. I don't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure.
They would light newspapers and throw them on the field. And actually, the iguanas, they would throw them out on the field.
Oh, my.
And they'd run around. They weren't very nice to them. They'd, like, sew their mouths shut, and they couldn't get enough oxygen through their nose, and they'd be going crazy out in the field.
Oh, my.
And, I had a couple of players chase me around the practice field a few times with claws.
Oh, my goodness.
They don't look good. They don't look good, but they're not, you know, they're not poisonous, and they're not going to attack you.
Sure.
But I didn't know that at the time.
You mentioned your father was he owned a gas station, and one of your off-season jobs to make some money is you drove fuel trucks in the off-season. Is that correct?
Where'd you get all this information out?
Hey, I know all about you, Jack.
Yes, I did. I was one of the best fuel oil truck drivers in town. I could pump a lot of fuel when the cold. When you're in Florida, mm-hmm. and you're pumping fuel oil, you don't get the opportunity to make a whole lot of money. But
sure.
Like right now, it's been cold. Last night I went to a ball game. It was in the 40s. When it gets cold, they pay you by the gallon, not by the hour. Mm-hmm. And I was pretty good, and that kept me in shape. If you've ever pulled a fuel oil hose through backyards in 55-gallon tanks in Florida in the middle of the winter up, practically until 1, 2 o'clock in the morning because everybody needs the fuel oil. They don't wait until the last minute to order it. that kept me in shape. You throw the hose over your shoulder and start running away from the truck. And I learned real quick how to put the hose back in the truck with my foot and not my hand, because if you're running through yards with a hose, you don't know what you're going to pick up in the yard. If you got your hand on it when you're running the hose back into the truck, you can find out that there's a dog that lives in the yard by looking in your hand.
All right, yeah. So you from Houston, you were taken by Montreal in the 1968 expansion draft, but
from the Dodgers.
Yeah. You were taken by Montreal, but then you were sent to Houston as compensation for a trade in which the Expos acquired Rusty Staub for Don Clendenin,
and Jesus Alou.
That's correct.
Yeah.
But because Clendenin didn't report to the Astros, Commissioner Bowie Kuhn ordered the Expos to send cash and a couple of players instead, and you were one of those players.
Right. Myself, Cash, and a kid by the name of Skip Gwynn, a little left-handed pitcher.
So this kind of sets up that Don Clendenin kind of sets up your arrival eventually to the Reds
in a roundabout way.
Yeah.
Well, that worked perfect in a lot of ways, and it worked perfect as far as my life and my daughter are concerned, because my wife was pregnant all during this time where I went to spring training with the Expos. And 3 days before the season started, they traded me, or they sent me in compensation for Don Clendenin to Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a funny but sad story. My brother was on a leave just before he went to Vietnam. And he has to drive my car from Florida to Montreal. And he gets up in northern New York. He's got a half a day to get into Montreal. He turns the TV on, and it says Bellingham traded to Houston. So he had to turn around and drive all the way back to Houston. You
know. What kind of car was it? Do you remember?
It was a Chevy station wagon. It was a decent car.
It was a decent car.
Family car. But he came to, you know, his last 6 days before he went over Vietnam, it was almost like he was on the highway. But Houston treated him very well when he got to Houston. I told Speck Richardson the story. And he put him up in a hotel for a day and then flew him home and really took care of him.
Really took care of him.
But, no, I came to Houston as a reliever, and that it was just competition for Don Clendenin, who actually was the MVP, I think, of the World Series that year with the Mets. Ended up with the Mets that year. But the other thing was my wife was pregnant, and we went to Houston, and my daughter was born at 6 months. She was 3 months premature. And I just felt, because we were in Houston and the medical doctors and the medical hospitals there in Houston, she is now a healthy 48-year-old beautiful woman. And when you have a child that was born and weighed right around 2 pounds and possibly less.
Oh, wow.
And at that time she was in the hospital for 76 days. And I don't know, it just turned out good. Going to Houston, and I came there as a reliever, got an opportunity to start after a year there, and I stayed a starter the rest of my career.
Yeah, I saw where you mentioned that you enjoyed pitching in that ballpark. You at that time, that was the Astrodome, and you liked pitching there, right?
I loved it. You know, everybody said, why do you want to go to the Astrodome? I was a sinker ball pitcher, which means you're going to get more ground balls. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, it's got AstroTurf. That ball's going to shoot through there. Well, the AstroTurf, infielders played back farther. The ball did get to them quicker, but there was no bad hops. Every day when I went to the ballpark, and I can't remember when the game started, say 7:30 or 7:10, you knew the game was going to start. There was no rain delays.
Yeah.
Temperature was the same every day you went to the ballpark. And one of the biggest things was it was a big ballpark. So
you could get away with
a big shot. It took a big shot to get it out of the ballpark. So I enjoyed it. I enjoyed Houston. We almost bought a house in Houston, but when we were looking for homes, we decided to come home to Florida, and it was a good thing we did. We were there 3 years because if you're really thinking about buying a home, I thought I'd establish myself there. That's the year you get traded. That's the year I did get traded.
Yeah, you were 29 years old. You came over in arguably one of the biggest trades in baseball history. You came over with Dennis Mehnke, Cesar Geronimo, and Ed Armbrister, and the one and only Joe Morgan from the Astros.
Joe Morgan was a throw-in.
He was the throw-in. Yeah, I was saving him for last on that one.
Yeah.
You came over for Tommy Helms, Jimmy Stewart, and our mutual friend Lee May. And
Big Mo.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to get your thoughts on what your feelings were like and what your thoughts were when you were told that you were getting traded with several of your teammates and you were going to Cincinnati.
Well, I'd gone out that winter to have some surgery on my leg. I had varicose veins in the case, stripped them after the 71 season. And we were a pretty good ball club. We were coming up. We had John Mayberry, Cesar Geronimo. You know, actually, Cesar Geronimo wasn't part of the team. Cesar Cedeno, I meant to say. Bob Watson, Jimmy Wynn, Joe Morgan. You know, we had a pretty good ball club. Mm-hmm. We had Don Wilson, Berker. We had some good starters, and Mehnke lived there, and when I was out there with surgery, he came, we were talking about how we felt that the team was on a move, and then the team doctor who came in to see me at the hospital a few times, he says, I was up in Speck Richardson's office, who was the general manager, and your name was mentioned quite a few times in trades, and I'm going, oh my gosh, you know, so. Home, and they called me, told me I was traded to the Reds, and I'm going, okay, that's good. And then a few minutes later, Sparky called me and welcomed me, and he said, one of my coaches, George Sugar, who I'd played with in the Dodger system in Salisbury, North Carolina, he says, you're a competitor, and he says, I'm looking forward to having you on the get a haircut before you show up for spring training. So, you know, Shugs and I, and we were talking about, that's funny you say this, I was talking about Shugs last night to my grandson, and Shugs was probably the toughest manager in the minor leagues. You'd hear these stories, but they were true. We'd lose a ball game, and we'd come back up to our home field, and the lights would be on, and we'd wonder, why are the lights on? And it'd be like 11 o'clock at night, and Shugs would say, all right, put your workout stuff on. We're going to go work out. We'd work out until 1, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, my goodness.
And then the next day he says, I'll see you at 10. And we'd get there at 10, and he'd work us out. He'd run one of the pitchers. There was one guy that I guess he enjoyed beer or something or another, but there was one pitcher on the team that after he ran quite a bit, he would get sick. So we'd run until he got sick.
Oh my gosh.
George would say, okay, Toshara up, you know. But he was tough, but after every win, he'd say, nice going, you baby Dodgers. And after the season, you look back and you say, this guy worked our butts off, but I got to be better because, you know. So we were just talking about that last night, but he was a great man.
And when you came over in that trade and you knew George Sugar was Sparky's bench coach, did that kind of, you know, put a smile on your face knowing that you were going to be reunited with him?
Yes. And I had seen him the year before. I was playing with Houston, and he was working, I think, in the minor leagues with Cincinnati at that time. And he made it a point. I was standing in the left field, and he made it a point to come over and at the old stadium, Crosley. Jack, you know, and I look up, and there's old Shugs, and I hadn't seen him for years. But he just came over to say hello, and then the next year I'm sitting next to him in the dugout, which was kind of cool.
Yeah.
Kind of cool. Yeah, he was a very smart baseball person. People didn't know that. You know, he was Pete's bench coach. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a story. I don't know if you've heard it, but I know this is true, that Shugs was Sparky's kind of Sparky was a rookie. Shugs had played a couple of years in the Dodger system.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Sparky was a second baseman. Shugs was a shortstop. But Shugs kind of took care of Sparky when he was a rookie.
Mm-hmm.
And then they both started managing the minor leagues. And Sparky said, if I ever get to the big league, you're going to be one of my coaches. And Shug was a lifelong minor league manager. Sparky got the job, and he called Shugs up, and he says, you want a job in the big leagues? You know, and
kept his
so
word.
He stuck with his word. He kept his word.
Yeah.
He did that in Detroit, and for a coach that was actually played in the minor leagues, friend of Sparky's. He was a barber out there in California, cut Sparky's hair. And Sparky got the job in Detroit. Called him up, and he said, you want a job? And I can't think of the guy's name. But anyway, he stayed 10 years with Sparky over in Detroit, or how long Sparky played over
it was,
there.
It wasn't Alex Grammas, was it?
No, Alex, you know, he spent 20 years with Sparky.
Okay, yeah.
No, it was, and we were just talking about him because I did the fantasy camp for Detroit about a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
Everybody loved him. This guy was super nice guy. Sparky did things like that people don't know about. Sparky and I had our differences a little bit off the field. We became real good friends.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because he was known as Captain Hook, and I think you prided yourself, especially during that era, as being a guy, once you get into the game, you're expected to pitch all nine innings. So that had to kind of clash with your ideology as far as what you were supposed to do, right?
Well, you know, I'm a pitcher. My job is to go out there and go nine innings, I figured.
Mm-hmm.
And Sparky, and he had the bullpen for it. But I'm out there, and all of a sudden, this little white-haired guy comes walking out there. It doesn't make you very happy. And when you think you can still do it, and you know how to get the next guy out. Mm-hmm. And Sparky had a rule. He says, when I come running out there, I'm going to tell you something, or I'm going to talk to Johnny. That's what it was all about. He never talked to us much on the mound. He talked to Johnny.
Mm-hmm.
But he ran out there, and he was either giving the guy in the bullpen to warm up or whatever. He says, but when I start walking out there, your game, stand on the mound and hand me the ball. He says, I won't show you up, and you don't show me up. And that's the way it was. And he didn't. You know, he came out and took you out of the ball game, but mm-hmm. I still wasn't happy.
Sure.
You know, there's a lot of games he took me out of that I felt that I could still get people out.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, they didn't take you out because of pitch count. They took you out because they felt like you might be getting tired or something.
Mm-hmm.
But
another question.
I never threw hard. And,
right.
I had my B plan. When my A plan started failing, I knew I could get him out with my B plan, but Sparky didn't let me go to my B plan very often.
Let me ask another question about Sparky, and I think it gets asked a little more nowadays because we're seeing the influx of young general managers that never played and managers that maybe were just, you know, minor league guys. Sparky never really, I'm pretty sure he didn't play in the majors.
Look that up. I think he did.
And if he did, it wasn't, you know, he didn't have like a superstar career or anything like that. Did that make it harder for you pitchers to, I think respect's a too strong of a word, but to really, you know, I guess that's what I'm saying is to respect him when he came out to lift you. You maybe in the back of your mind, you thought this guy never, you know, really made anything out of his playing career.
That never caught my mind. You know, you're either a good manager. Walter Alston never played in the big leagues. There's a lot of guys. You know, Tommy Lasorda never played in the big leagues. There's a lot of guys that never played in the big leagues. One of the best pitching coaches I ever had was a guy by the name of Lefty Phillips and Larry Shepard. They never played in the big leagues. So that didn't even come into my mind. I always said, though, once I found out, and I think I found it out after my career, I went to a function and somebody said, you know, Sparky was a manager, but he wasn't a very good player. And I said, well, he played for quite a few years, I know, in the Dodger system. And then he says, well, look at his stats. And I'm almost positive this. He showed me the stat that Sparky came up with Philadelphia one year.
Yeah, he did. That's absolutely correct. I have it in front of me right now. He played 152 games for the Phillies.
And he hit 196 or something. Lifetime batting average.
Mm-hmm.
How close are if you have it up front?
218 in 152 games in 1959 for the Phillies.
218. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's why he didn't like pitchers. There's no hitter that likes pitchers that hit 218.
That's pretty good.
You know, hopefully he was a good fielder, you know, but 218, especially back then, didn't make it, you know.
All right.
Nowadays, if you hit 218, you could make $3 a year. But no, he got a cup of coffee, as they say. But no, there's a lot of people to me that just know the game. Jim, I was just in Detroit camp. Mm-hmm. I think Jim Leland, he said his biggest dream was being a catcher in the big leagues. And he became possibly a Hall of Fame manager in the big leagues.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But he came short of his dream because he was a backup catcher in Double A. That's as high as he got, you know. And he was a great manager, you know. You don't have to be a good coach or a good manager and play in the big leagues.
I am touching without hands because you're deaf and blind. Don't try to reach my mind, collecting my fake. You're out of town, man. I am swimming in the dark because all your friends are shy.
Now, talk a little bit about that team you played for in Cincinnati. Obviously, during the peak years of the Big Red Machine, you and Don Gullett anchored that staff. You averaged 222 innings a season during those peak years. What was it like pitching on that team? And tell me a little bit about what it was like being in that clubhouse.
Well, the clubhouse was unbelievable. I mean, fun. They made it fun. Superstars were the main actors or main participants in the clubhouse. They would be on each other, joking with each other. And the rest of the guys, if we got down, couldn't get down in that clubhouse. I tell the story where I gave up a home run one game, and I went up to the clubhouse. I'm sure I lost the game. And I'm in my locker feeling sorry for myself. Tony says, Nottingham, you know, what's the problem? And I said, well, I don't feel very good about losing the ball game. And there, you're going to lose a lot. You know? And he says, by the way, show me how you held that fastball that the guy hit 400 feet. You know, and he started laughing. Ha, 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 you know. You couldn't. You know, they were on you all the time. And you knew you couldn't get down in that clubhouse because we never lost a long streak. You know, we always were up. If we got beat, we knew we were coming back the next day and usually beat them or win the ball game. I came from Houston. I was 10-15 my last year in Houston, and I lost 7 games, 2-1. What do you think happened to me when I came to Cincinnati?
You won those games.
Yes, I did. You know, I started off slow, and I was pitching okay. Started off slow. I think I was 0-5, and you know, all the fans really appreciated me. You know, they just gave away Lee May, who was the MVP of the team that year before, and Tommy Helms, who's a favorite, and Jimmy Stewart, who was a great guy. And I'm 0-5, and we're losing in 72. I heard a few boos and go back to Houston. But it was like it took the team about 6 weeks to start clicking. You know, it's like a family, you know. You get three or four new guys in the clubhouse. It takes a while for everybody to just, you know, click. And it seems like after about 6 weeks, boom. And then we win it in 72. Unfortunately, we lose to Oakland in the World Series. But it was just fun. I mean, to walk in the clubhouse, to walk there before a game that I'm starting, knowing that if I can keep the team in the game going in the sixth or seventh inning, we're going to win it. We're just going to win it. You know, we're that good. We're going to score runs. There was plenty of times where they didn't score runs, but more than likely we were going to score runs.
And you had the confidence.
Good hitting. You know, Seaver, Carlton, guys like that. That was tough. Gibson, you weren't going to score a whole lot of runs off those guys.
That's one of the things that when you hear these – the guys that played on the Big Red Machine, or even the fans, and Marty says it all the time when he's talking about that team, is what you just said. It's amazing how collectively you guys just knew that you were probably going to win, and if you didn't win at the end of the sixth inning, you're down, you know, 4-1 or whatever. You guys knew it. You had the confidence, and I think that. That's what amazes me about you guys, is that all of you guys believed in yourselves. And I think that was, you know, one of the first things about a great team is the confidence to know that you're going to win, or at least have a pretty good chance going into it.
Well, the best part about it is we knew we were going to win. We knew we were good. But the other team did too. Even though they might be ahead of us 2 runs or 1 run going in the late game. It's going to happen sooner or later. You know, they're good. You know, let's try to stay as long as we can. And it's like sometimes some of the weaker teams, they were waiting just for us to come back and beat them. They knew they were going to get beat. You know, which is fun to play on a team like that.
Yeah,
because I played on Houston in the first year or two I played there. Like I said, my last year we were starting to come together. But it was just like we went out there. You kind of get used to losing. You don't know how to win.
Right.
And that's just the feel we had. That was the deal in Cincinnati. We knew we were going to win. We knew we were good. You know, we knew that we were going to lose sometimes. I've never been on a baseball team that didn't lose ball games. You know.
Yeah.
You weren't going to lose as many.
Do you feel like the pitching staff got a little overshadowed by the grade eight?
That's kind of the question that I get asked all the time, and I ask that because you know we did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most people know that we did. If you're a baseball person, it doesn't take that much to realize.
Absolutely.
You know, you're talking about Gary Nolan, Freddie Norman, Jack Bellingham. You know, we traded Mike Caldwell to Milwaukee. He wins a lot of ball games. Trade Ross Grimsley. Milwaukee. Then Caldwell went to Milwaukee. Grimsley went to Baltimore. We had a lot of good pitchers. And you go with the bullpen. Pedro Bourbon, who could pitch every day. Clay Carroll could pitch almost all day when I first got there. Tom Hall, you know, and then you come in with Raleigh Eastwick, Will McEnany.
Wow.
you know, those are good pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
They went other places. Tommy Hume was a rookie coming up. Mm-hmm. Tom Carroll was a rookie coming up. We had good pitching. We had very good pitching. And speaking about pitching, we had backup guys in the infield, utility players. You know, you look at a Doug Flynn, he goes to New York and wins a Gold Glove.
Mm-hmm.
You look at Darryl Chaney, he goes to Atlanta, plays shortstop for Atlanta. You, But the Bill Plummer, he goes to Seattle and is their number one catcher in Seattle. Mm-hmm. You know, so this was a team not only that was great on the field, the Big Eight, they had 25 guys that could play the ball, play the game well, and knew how to play the game.
Mm-hmm. You got some advice from Roberto Clemente one year, right?
Yes, I did. Not too many people know these things. Where'd you get this stuff?
What did he tell you?
Well, it was my second year, I want to say, and in the big leagues. And I played in Nicaragua, Dominican Republic, Venezuela. When I played in Dominican, my outfield was made up of Felipe Alou, Jesus Alou, and Matty Alou. And Matty played in Pittsburgh. So I'd always talk to him when I came into town, and I got to know Roberto through Matty, mm-hmm. Mateo. And we're in Houston one night, and I come in relief against Pittsburgh. And I just get the living hell kicked out of me, you know, home runs, mm-hmm. base hits. I'm picking behind in the count. Got to come in with a fastball, boom, you know. So I'm in the outfield the next day, getting ready to do my sprints and my exercise. And I heard this, "Hey kid," and I'm kind of looking around. "Hey kid," and I look over and it's Roberto Clemente. And he says, "Come here." So I'm going, "Roberto Clemente, damn." You know, he wants to talk to me. You know, I've met him a few times through. He says, "Let me tell you something." He says, "You got too good at stuff to pitch like that." He says, "Go right after us. Don't pick. When you pick, you go into an obvious pitch situation. And we know what's coming, and we can hit it when we know it's coming. You got too good at stuff. If you put a question mark in our head, you can get anybody up." And I'm going, "Wow." You know, the opposing guy is telling me this, you know, Roberto Clemente on top of it. So just little things like that through my career, you know, I listened and it was a big boost. I mean, that was a big, big boost for me.
I'm sure. Yeah.
You know, I, sometimes you're not real sure of yourself sometimes. And mm-hmm. I think in that everywhere. You know, if you're not real sure of yourself, you're not confident in yourself, you're not going to succeed. And then after Roberto Clemente told me, "Hey, kid, you got too good at stuff. If you stay ahead in the count, stay away from the obvious pitch situation, you know, hitters will get themselves out."
Wow, that's great. That's something you'll always be able to tell your grandkids.
Oh, I tell that. I told his son that. I was up at the All-Star game this year and met his son.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I told his son, I said, "You know, your dad called me over one time," and I told him the story. I said how much he meant to me.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic. I'm sure he appreciated that as well.
Well, he sounded like he did. You know, I'm sure his dad was a good man, and I'm sure he's heard good stories all of his life about him.
Mm-hmm. You know. Going back to the Reds for a second, I think one of the years I think that, you know, that gets kind of overlooked and a season that I'm sure you're very proud of was that 1973 season when you guys were 11 games out for fourth place at the end of June. Of course, Hal King hits one of the most dramatic home runs in Reds history when bottom of the ninth off Don Sutton, he connects on a two out, two strike pitch. And after that, it turned your season around. You guys eventually would go on to beat the Dodgers. But I think what unofficially clinched that season was your bases loaded double against the Dodgers in September of that season, completed a 7-3 win. And it gave you guys a 5-game lead over the Dodgers with 16 left to play. Do you remember the double that you hit?
Well, no, I hit so many of them. I can't quite remember that one. Yes, I remember that.
I wasn't sure if I picked up on the sarcasm.
I remember well, and you know, to me, it was a big game. You know, if we would have lost that game, it was three out instead of five out. When you're five out, that sounds a lot better than three.
Sure.
But I came up, and I remember going up the plate, and I'm thinking Claude Osteen's pitching. And I did hit left-handers better than right-handers. If you were right-hander, threw me a curve, I would back out of the batter's box. You know, I always thought I couldn't see the spin of the ball, so Mm-hmm. I always thought that ball was maybe going to hit me, and then it would break over the plate. But a left-hander, the ball's coming into you. And he hung a slider, I want to say. And I always hit the right field. The Dodgers knew I hit the right field. Mm-hmm. And I hit a, I want to call it, was a screamer line drive, but I don't think it was quite that. I hit a ball to the left center, more towards center. Mm-hmm. And Willie Davis was playing me to hit the right. Mm-hmm. And I hit it good, and the bases were loaded. There had to be two outs. That's why the runners were running, I guess. Mm-hmm. but, yes, it went in the gap. I slid into second base, stood up, and everybody was going crazy in the stands. And Joe Nuxall, and I want to say Marty at the time, had bets on pitchers. Who was going to get the most hits, hit for the highest average. And Nuxall had me. And he had announced it on radio at the time. And he was standing up, waving and everything else. And I thought everybody was standing up and yelling for me. But I turn around, they're all looking at Nuxall. I'm standing on second base saying, hell, that was great, Jack. And nobody cared about Jack. They cared about Nuxall screaming and yelling. So, but, no, I remember that well.
Yeah.
And I remember also in the newspaper the next day, Osteen said something to Willie Davis about how can you play him like that? And Willie got mad at Osteen and said something about how can you throw him a hanging curveball? And it caused some ruckus in the clubhouse. But it was always good to, you know, I still have a little bit of Dodger blue in me, as they say.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But it was always good to beat them. You always wanted to do well against them,
right?
You know, so it was fun beating the Dodgers, and that I remember that well.
Yeah.
I think I had two or three doubles in my career, so you remember?
Sure.
All
of them. You never.
That was a big double. That was a big. Three absolutely. RBIs is probably more than I ever had in a year.
You never got that home run, but you did. Your first hit came off a Hall of Famer. Can you tell us that story?
No. My first hit in the big leagues?
Yeah, yeah. Your first
came
hit
off
was
a
off
Hall of Famer?
Fergie Jenkins.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I can't tell you the story because I don't remember it. But
it was at Wrigley Field. You hit a little, the way it was described, you hit a almost like a Texas leaguer. It was your first hit in August of 1969 when you were with Houston.
Okay.
It was the first game of a doubleheader.
Okay, I must have started that game then. It was the first game of a doubleheader.
Yeah.
It had to be a little blooper over into the right field area.
It's a screamer in the box score.
I do tell people that I think I got base hits off everybody, all Hall of Famers, you know, Tom Seaver, Steve Carlton, Nolan Ryan.
Fergie
they
Jenkins.
All were to right field. And my theory was I always swung. I didn't stand up there. You know, so yeah, there's a chance the ball might hit the bat.
Now, you're the guy that also gave up the home run for Hank's 714th home run in 1974. Probably at the time you weren't thrilled about it, but you got to look back on it now as something kind of neat.
Well, it is neat, and I have no problem giving it up. To me, Hank Aaron was a class act, and I got a couple of telephone calls when Bonds was going to break his record.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't appreciate Bonds. I mean, he's, you know, he gets home runs. He's supposed to be a steroid guy. But what I don't appreciate it is the steroid part and what he does after he hits a home run.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he stands there, flips his bat, and watches the ball go out of the ballpark. Hank Aaron, I'm almost positive. I didn't watch him. I was worried more about the ball going over the fence than the way he was running. But
mm-hmm.
we respected each other. We didn't try to show each other up on the field. He hit a home run off and he ran, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he hit the home run and ran around the bases. And he didn't show me up, didn't show anything up. He hit, I think he hit about seven off of me. And he hit one off of me late in the season before. and I was being interviewed, and somebody said, are you going to just groove one to him if it's got a chance to be 714 or 715? And I said, you don't have to groove one to Hank Aaron. He's going to hit home runs, you know. And there again, there was two men on. I was behind in the count, which means he knew what was coming.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to challenge him. It's a round ball and a round bat. And, you know, he's not going to hit a home run every time. He's going to miss the pitch, ground out, pop up, hit it hard to somebody. I got people out there with gloves.
Yep.
But unfortunately, he swung and he hit it right on the nail and hit the line drive over the left field fence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the worst part about that is standing out there on the mound, Vice President Ford was there, all kinds of Jackie Robinson was there.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a 20-minute ceremony. And I had to stand there and watch it on the field. And I'm first inning, I'm down 3-0. So that's not the best feeling in the world.
Sure.
But
and it's cold, I'm sure, right? Opening day.
It wasn't that. I don't think it was that cold.
Okay.
But I can't remember the weather. Once you get your adrenaline going, once you start pitching, the cold really doesn't bother you.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
Pitchers are lucky in that way that we're always moving. If you're staying in the outfield and you're not moving much, it can get real cold out there.
Yeah.
But when you're pitching and you're moving and you're not necessarily sweating in cold weather, but you don't feel the cold as much. But no, I talk about that. People tell me that all the time. How'd you feel? Well, I didn't feel real good, but
yeah, sure.
You know, it's not like some young kid, you know, he hit 514. He had ended up hitting, how many did he hit?
So he was 755.
714, I mean, yeah. 755. So
yeah.
He had more off-time Drysdale, I think, than he hit off anybody.
Yeah, and he's a Hall of Famer. So there you go.
Yeah, so, no. We won the game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you know that? Did you mention that?
You won the game. You won the
game,
Jack.
I didn't win the game. I was out in the fourth
Your
inning.
Your team won the game.
No, the team won the game, and that was the most important thing. You know, my team got me off the hook for a loss, and we came back and won the game, which was what it was all about. So that's the main thing. When you're behind, I think we were behind 3 runs in the first inning. We came back and won the game. If I was with Houston, we're down 3 runs in the first inning, I can almost chalk up a loss because we're not going to come back. So that was the difference in playing for the Big Red Machine. And the clubhouse, I mean, the clubhouse was the best clubhouse I'd ever been in. Just the way guys got together, you know, it doesn't mean we didn't have our problems. You got 25 guys living together for 6 months.
Yeah, sure.
You're going to have your differences. But,
of course.
But no, it was great. It was great. And the big thing that helped, too, is the coaches. I mean, George Sugar, we had Russ Nixon at times, Lazinski, you know, Alex Grammas was there. You know, we had the whole combination, the whole everything just mixed in perfectly. I mean, the extra players, Sugar took care of them. Larry Shepard took care of the pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
And Klazuski took care of the hitters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody asked me about Klazuski at one time, and I don't know 100%. I heard that Klazuski didn't necessarily try to coach you so much unless you needed it. If you went to him, he coached you. But he didn't try to overcoach. He didn't try to come and, you know, teach you he used to hit or anything, you know. He looked at you and he saw your best swing, and when you came to him, he tried to get it back to that.
Mm-hmm.
But we had some great athletes. They did a whole lot of help.
Yeah.
But I think it's all a mind, too, you know.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Shep was good. He knew me. He knew how to get on my butt, make me work harder. You know, he would yell at you. But you knew the yelling was because he loved you, not because he was trying to bust your butt and
tear
you down. He was trying to help you, you know. So it was just a cool all-around situation.
I think
very
one
fortunate.
Of the
I was in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, absolutely. Don Clendenin, again, comes through for you.
Yes.
I think one of the most unusual things that really shows a difference between nowadays compared to as early or as late as the 70s was, I mean, you're starting opening day in 1974. You're pitching for one of the best teams in baseball, if not the best team in baseball. And you still had to work in the off season, right? Like, to make a few bucks?
Well, I didn't work that much when I got up to Cincinnati. I worked one winter at, I want to say it was Glenway Chrysler, Plymouth.
Mm-hmm.
I had a talent tree I had bought through my wife's uncle out of New York. It was too big a car and too nice a car for my wife and I, but he gave us a good deal on it, so we bought it. And I used to go in there for service, and the manager and the owner, and I can't remember his name right now, said, how would you like to come work for us? So I was the consumer's manager, which I grew up in a gas station. I knew how to change the oil and check the tires and check the oil and wash the windshield, but I was not a consumer service manager, whatever that meant. But the main thing was they'd come in for service. I would meet the people out there getting service. I'd go in there and buy them a cup of coffee and just bull, you know. And
yeah,
half
sure.
of them knew who Jack Billingham was and didn't. But I had time just talking to the people. I said, I'm not going to work all the time. I got kids going to school. He says, well, come in after they go to school and you can leave about 1, 2 o'clock. So I did that for about 2 months. And then I started thinking about trying to get in shape and going down the clubhouse and playing catch with Gary Nolan and things. And I went in, I talked to him. But I had a good time meeting people. Then I'd call them up a week later and say, how was our service? And how do you like this and that? You know, it was
I'm Jack Billingham.
No, well, like I said, some of them knew, some of them didn't.
Yeah.
You know, but when I was coming up in the minor leagues, definitely. That's why I played in Nicaragua and Venezuela, Dominican. You can make more money down there than you can make in the States, minor league ball.
Yeah.
So you did anything you could to survive.
Yeah.
And,
of course, absolutely.
And you don't make much money, or you didn't make much money in the minor leagues back then. So you had to do something. But I was a good fuel oil truck driver. I could go in anywhere when I came home after the season. I had a reputation in Orlando. Jack can pump some fuel.
He can throw some gas and he can pump some fuel.
Well, I didn't throw gas. You never saw me. I threw a sinker ball pitcher. Gullet was a gas thrower. I was a sinker ball.
Yeah.
So.
Hey, what was it like pitching the bench?
Excellent. I was very fortunate. My rookie year, I pitched to a guy by the name of Tom Haller. He had spent 10 years with Sansco and whatever he was against. I came up. I didn't even know half the players I was pitching against. And I'll tell you a story in a second about that. But I wasn't a big rah-rah baseball person. I love baseball. I love to play it. But I never, being from Florida, I never had a favorite team. You know, you heard of Mickey Mantle. But he was, you could throw anything he pitched. You could throw in a bit of dirt when you're ahead in the count. You knew he was going to block it. You could stand out there with a man on first base, and they didn't think so much of stealing and times at home and everything then, but people didn't steal against me. It wasn't that they didn't steal against me. They didn't steal against Johnny Bench, but he got, because he had a great arm. You know,
right.
If they got a good jump off me, Johnny could make it up with his arm. So he didn't have, you know, Lou Brock. You know, he'd steal a base off me every once in a while. But if I could gave Johnny a shot at throwing him out, he wouldn't steal. He knew that Johnny's arm would catch up to him. You know, the baseball goes faster than the legs, you know. So if you got a good jump, Johnny's arm was picked. But Johnny and I worked together. I pitched Tom Haller, John Edwards, who caught for the Reds. Actually, I think he caught some of Jim Maloney's no-hitters. He was in Houston. So I learned the hitters through them, you know, how to pitch to them. And then by the time I got to Cincinnati, Johnny was 2 or 3 years, I think, in the big leagues, and so was I. And we worked very together. You know, I knew what I wanted to do. I very seldom shook them off. I only had a fastball and a curveball, so, you know, he was right. You only could be wrong 50% of the time with two pitches, you know. And we never shook off. I kind of just took a little extra stare and he had changed the signs. But, no, we worked very well together. He could receive the ball. He was a big person back there. Mm-hmm. But he just received the ball well. They framed the ball well. There's phrases of the baseball players. A lot of catchers will catch the ball and kind of pull it out of the strike zone. He would catch it and kind of frame it into the strike zone. Mm. He would get pitches for me with just by the way he received the ball. he was great. I think everybody in the world knows he's great. Sure. He was fun to throw to. And I want to say that I felt like I was pretty easy to catch, too. I wasn't a real gun going hard, threw hard. I was pretty consistent where my pitches were going to be. When he called a pitch a certain place, it was going to be somewhere in that area. So it was easy for him to catch. And I think that helped him at the plate. That he was more relaxed at the plate because I was easier to catch than some guys.
Yeah.
And he always hit well for me when I pitched. He always hit. He hit quite a few home runs, and I think his average was pretty high.
When he caught you, right? Of course.
Yeah, when he caught me. Well, when he caught everybody, he had pretty good years. I think he did when he was. I think if you look at his average when I pitched or home runs, I think he probably wore home runs. I might have hit a little bit higher on average when I pitched than some of the other guys.
Yeah, it's got to be a direct correlation, I would think.
Yeah. And it wasn't like he was in a slump when he had caught the other guys. You know, he was pretty good all around.
Was he catching in 1974 against the Pirates when you plunked that batter and they got into that wild brawl in which Pedro Bourbon bit
Plummer.
Somebody?
That
was Bill Plummer.
Yeah, that was. I remember that because Bill Plummer was kind of a hard nosed. He was a friend of mine, but he was hard-nosed. He went out there. He would, if there was a fight, he wouldn't back away from it. And I can't remember. Earlier in the game, it was Bruce Keeson, I want to say.
Yeah, yeah. Yep, that's it.
Hit a couple of our hitters or knocked them down or something or other. Then Sparky talked to us and said, you know, if he comes up, nobody's on, brush him back, more or less. Throw a ball in his rib cage. He came up, but there was a man on first base. So Sparky had told Bill, don't call a knockdown pitch if somebody's on base. Well, Bill calls a knockdown pitch, you know, which is the thumb. You throw the thumb out.
Yeah.
You give signs with your fingers. If thumb goes out, you're brushing a guy back.
Or rib cage.
If he squared around the bunt, and I threw a fastball inside, which would have maybe hit him in the ribs. But because he turned around and bunted, the ball was right at his forehead. And it didn't hit him in the forehead, but I think it did hit him, or he went down and all benches cleared. I remember Doc Ellis yelling at me, and I knew Doc from playing with him in Dominican. Why'd you throw at his head? Why'd you throw at his head? And all hell broke loose. I want to say it kind of broke up, and there was a catcher by the name of Kirkpatrick, backup catcher, and he stepped on Sparky's toe.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And Andy Costco shoved him off Sparky's toe, and all hell broke loose again. And there was fights everywhere, you know.
That's where Pedro bit some guy?
guy, Pedro had a guy. I want to say his name was Peterson. He had a headlock. This guy had Pedro in a headlock, was choking him. And Pedro just couldn't get out of it, so he just opened his mouth and took a big old chunk out of the side of his hip. Guy had to go to the hospital and get a tetanus shot afterwards.
Yeah.
But no, that was quite something. I don't think anybody really got hurt in that, but it was a pretty good fight. Pretty good
fight. Have you been in some good ones? Or is that the only one? Or?
You know, there's mostly benches clear. By the time you get out there, you know, it's broken up. Mm-hmm. I remember one, and I don't even know how it started, but I remember my head ended up in the hole in front of the rubber. The pitch was down. Hank Aaron and Doug Rader were going at it, wrestling. And I went over to try to break it up. Here's two big old strong guys, tall and skinny, not as strong as them, and they both fell on me on the mound.
Jeez.
And it's like 10 other people start coming and piling on. And my head was right in front of the rubber in the hole.
Yeah.
And that's not a good feeling on the bottom of the pile. And something happened to my lip. I don't know. When you get into stuff like that, you don't really feel somebody punching you or falling you. But I knew I wasn't very comfortable under there. Then when I came up, my lip was bleeding and my forehead was scratched. But I didn't even know what happened other than I had about 1,000 pounds laying on top of me.
Sure, sure.
So, I hit one guy. I led the National League twice and hit batman.
Yeah.
And I only tried to hit one guy. When I pitched, I tried to brush guys back, get them off the plate. If they started getting too close to plate and diving out on fastballs away, I'd stand them up, as they said. And I ended up hitting, like I said, a 16-15, which led the National League 2 years.
Yeah.
But we were playing Atlanta when I was with Houston, and it was one of those nights where I was getting beat around pretty much, and they brought me in. Actually, just to clean up the mess that had started. We were down by like 12-0 against Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And this little left-handed hitter, he didn't spend much time in the big leagues. He came up, and I was 3-0 on him, which respect back then is take the pitch.
Mm-hmm.
He swung, turned around, fell on the plate. And I'm going, uh-oh.
Yeah.
So he gets in the batter's box, and I start a fastball behind his back, and it runs into his rib cage, and he goes down on one knee and runs to first base. And I'm thinking, maybe we started something here.
Yeah.
Well, the next day, Hank Aaron says, Jack, same thing as Roberto Clemente, Jack, come over here. And I'm going, oh, hell.
Uh-huh.
And he said, everybody on our dugout knew you were going to drill him. He says, you should have drilled him. He says he should never swung a pitch. So, that was the only guy I ever tried to hit, and he showed me up.
Yeah.
And everybody in their dugout knew he showed me up.
Yeah.
Only me, the team. You know, when you're getting beat by 12 runs, you know, as you notice, they don't run the score up at third base. If somebody has a chance to score,
a
lot of times they hold the runner up at third base, or they used to. I don't know what they do now.
It's still goes on today.
Yeah, you respect the other team. You don't want to kill them.
Yeah.
You know, if they're having a bad day.
Yeah.
You're having a good day, so just leave it as that.
Mm-hmm. So. All right, Jack, we'll give you one more question. We'll let you go
one
after this.
One more question.
You've been so generous with your time this morning, so I just want to let everybody know that you're very active still with the Reds. You come to camp each year to instruct the pitchers for a week. You still scheduled to do that, and I know that you still do fantasy camp. You mentioned doing the Tigers camp. You still do Reds fantasy camp. I was privileged to be part of that 1 year with you, and you really made my time there memorable.
You know, you and your long hair. I remember that well. I remember.
Yeah.
You can play baseball, though. You've been around the game. You can play. You can play. But, no, I'm very fortunate. Since the Castellinis became owners, they include a bunch of us old-timers and different things. And then I'm active in the Hall of Fame. Fortunately, I'm in the Cincinnati Reds Hall of Fame, and this year we're coming up for the Pete Rose induction.
Sure.
And then They called me about a month or so ago. I think they're going to make a bobblehead out of Jack Billingham at the Hall of Fame.
That is
outstanding.
You go
in the Hall of Fame, you get a bobblehead.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm going to be up there a couple of days. And I used to go to spring training with the Reds. They asked me this year to go out March 10th. Jim Maloney mostly, just the two of us. Doug Flynn mm-hmm. goes out there. But I told Dick Williams last year, I got one grandson left in high school, mm-hmm. and he's pretty good at baseball. That's where I was last night watching him pitch. Mm-hmm. And I told him, I said, I appreciate the invitation, but I only got a couple more years watching my grandkids. Mm-hmm. Down in Florida, this is the time of year where they start.
Yeah.
So I said, I'd rather, not meaning anything bad, I said I'd rather play, watch my grandson
of
play.
Of course, yeah, absolutely.
The Reds right now.
Yeah, sure.
And he understood.
Of course.
But he did invite me back this year, but I told him the same thing. He's a junior, and he's one of the better players on the team, and mm-hmm. that's my life right now.
Yeah.
Watching the grandkids while being around here. I got only a couple of short years. Hopefully he can get us some type of scholarship and play a little bit. He's a pretty good ball player, but year at a time, but it's the time for my grandkids. So.
Yep, absolutely.
But they include me in a lot of things. I'm very blessed to be with the Big Red Machine because people haven't forgotten the Big Red Machine yet, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I was
of
a part of it. I'm going to Grand Rapids, Michigan at a minor league facility for the Tigers, sign autographs. And, you know, we do quite a few things, golf tournament stuff. So I'm very fortunate to see a bunch of old-timers that I played with years ago. Unfortunately,
Do you still watch the Reds on TV?
I do, not on a regular basis. I don't watch any of baseball on a regular basis, but I pull for the Reds. I'm pulling for them to have a decent season this year. I think they've made a lot of changes, and they'll admit that they don't plan on winning any World Series, but you never know in baseball.
Yeah.
You know, I got a friend of mine is coaching in Tampa Bay, pitching coach Jim Hickey.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, I'm going to watch Seattle as much as possible because I coached in the Astros system for 18 years. And I had a guy like Scotty Service, his manager, Manny Act, that was a player when I was coaching, and then he became a manager. And he's a third base coach. Mm-hmm. And Tim Bogard is bench coach, and I worked with him in Greenville, Tennessee with the Astros. Mm-hmm. So I've got quite a few people out there that I'm going to be watching or watching the team, pulling for the team.
Of course.
So, yes, I do watch baseball, but I don't sit down and watch it every night. You know, I do read the paper and see what happens every day. But baseball, my life is grandkids.
Right now. Absolutely.
So. But I've been blessed. I got a good life, and baseball still includes me in it. So.
Yeah, absolutely. As it should. You're a Reds Hall of Famer. You heck of a big league pitcher for many years, and you have some great stories to tell. I could go on and on with you, and I just listen to you forever. You're a great storyteller, and you have a lot of experience. And first and foremost, you're a good man, and I'm very happy to know you, and I'm very grateful that you agreed to come on to talk with us today.
Anything to do with the Reds, I'm happy to do it.
All right, Jack Billingham, thank you so much, and we'll catch up with you down the line.
You all have a good day. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jack. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Boy, Jack is one of those guys who, as a Reds fan, I'll always treasure. He's a world-class, unassuming guy who spent his entire professional career around baseball royalty and probably fit right in the whole time. I first got to know Jack when I spent a week at Reds Fantasy Camp in 2011. He chided me about the length of my hair and always gave me a hard time about this or that. But I loved every minute of it because I knew he was kidding around with me. At least I hope he was. His stories about not only Sparky and the Big Red Machine, but also of Hank Aaron and Roberto Clemente are amazing. It was a real privilege having Jack Billingham on this episode of the BOR Podcast. Thank yous go out this week to Jack Billingham, Aaron Chamberlain, the Cincinnati Reds Hall of Fame and Museum, and my pal Lisa Braun. A very special thanks to my main man, Nick Prince, the best technical director in the world of podcasting. Without Nick, this podcast would not exist.
Music this week was provided by the super talented indie rock band from Madrid, Spain called The Hinds. Please pick up their new album called Leave Me Alone, which is available now on iTunes. Don't forget to join us for the Reds Hot Stove League and Better Off Red Baseball Trivia at the Holy Grail Banks on Tuesday, February 16th and Tuesday, February 23rd. The podcast will be on a bit of a hiatus for the next couple of weeks, but we'll return by the end of February with more great guests. That's all from BOR headquarters. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jamie Ramsey. Expect good news.